Hello, this is News for Scotland. I'm Hugh Stewart, and this is Jeanette Hill, and here's this week's news for the second week of April. We're going to begin with the economy. The Fraser Valentin Institute, Strathclyde University, has been looking at consumption trends. Consumption means ordinary spending by you and me on goods and services and normal things we buy, and also not just goods, but also intangibles like holidays, software, insurance, things like that. So all consumption is a very big part of the economy. In fact, it's 60% really. So if consumption is not growing, it's unlikely that the economy is going to be thriving. Now, I've looked at a paper by Joel Souza of the Fraser Valander, and he's graphed the consumption trends over the last 30 years. There had been a steady increase up until the banking collapse. So years 2007-2008 was followed by a recession, big drop in consumption then. After that, it was gradually picking up again until 2019. And not surprisingly, it collapsed during the COVID years, 19-21. Since then, a small upturn. Real consumer spending, however, is only 3.6% higher than it was back in 2007. So really, our spending has hardly grown over that long timescale. And since 2019, after the COVID recovery, the last few months it seems to have dropped again. Now, the last downturn can be explained by taxes. Whatever the UK government says with its famous tax giveaway budget last March, we're actually paying more in taxes. So it's you don't have to be an economist to realise if people's taxes are increasing, their take-home pay is down, and so their consumption spending is down. So not surprising. In 1857, Ernest Engel, as I'm sure you know, Jeanette, argued that food as a percentage of our spending will tend to go down as we become richer. In other words, if families rise up through the income scale, they don't need to spend more and more on food. There comes a point where you've had enough and you start spending your money on other things and fun things. So what that means is that if you expect the economy to be doing well, if people are improving their prosperity, you'd expect the proportion they spend on food to be falling over the years. But guess what? If you look at the graph, it's pretty flat. Over a long period of time, people spending on food as a percentage isn't really changing. So that, again, is an indication that people aren't doing too well. Now, one interesting point to note is that we're spending less on transport. Before the pandemic, we were typically spending about 14% of our incomes on all types of transport, public and private cars. But now, comparatively, we're spending about £500 a year less. And from 14% is down to 12.5%. Now, those are just the figures. We don't really know why that is, but is it an increase on people working at home, which, of course, a lot of people took up during COVID? And if we are spending less on transport, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, next story on bees. If you were listening to us on the Spotify, the audio version last week, yeah, it goes out on Spotify on Podbeam and various other platforms. So if you haven't heard that, you can pick that up again. There was a story on bees last week. The bee population is under threat by the yellow-legged Asian hornet, which is in Yorkshire. So will it make its way up the A1? Now, that's a notifiable creature. Is that the right word? Anyway, if you find one, you're supposed to report it, and you can find out who you reported to on last week's programme. Because I didn't make a note of that. There's a hotline.
Put it on Facebook, don't worry.
Right, okay. Now, but this week, though, we've just heard that another threat to the bee population comes from a disease. It's called American Foulbrood, or AFB. Now, this disease has been picked up last week in a beehive in Perthshire. So any beehives within 3 kilometres of that one are asked to be very careful with their biosecurity. That means to watch what goes in and out of the beehive, both bees and equipment. Now, it turns out that, I didn't notice, Jeanette, but there are about 1,400 hobby beekeepers in Scotland who are members of the association, the SBA, and so they should be notified of outbreaks of the disease, the AFB. However, there's probably also about 1,000 beekeepers who are not members of the association. So the Scottish Government says to them, whether you're a member or not, could you get yourself informed, and you can register with a site called BeeBase. And then you can hear if there's any infections in your area. And, of course, if you're unfortunate enough to get one in your beehive, you need to tell people about it. Now, I don't have a beehive, and I don't know anyone who does have a beehive, but bees are incredibly important. Throughout the world, 75% of our food, that's fruit, nuts, vegetables, depends on pollinators such as bees. So they really are crucial to keeping us all alive. So we have to look after the bees. Palestinian protest. Now, in a couple of minutes, Jeanette's going to talk about a talk to Hamza Youssef, well, an interview he gave the other day to the BBC. So let me begin with Hamza Youssef's position on Gaza. A couple of days ago, he wrote to the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak demanding an end to arms sales to Israel. The First Minister pointed out that British-based companies continue to arm Israel in spite of the growing death toll among children, women and medics and aid workers. Describing these deaths as intolerable, the First Minister said the UK government would be complicit in the killing of innocent civilians if it doesn't stop. Mr. Youssef previously wrote to the UK Prime Minister on the 23rd of February, but has yet to receive a reply. Protests against the Israeli army's attack on Gaza did take place across Scotland last weekend, and we observed three in Edinburgh last Saturday. Now, some of the footage of that will be on our YouTube channel. We'll tell you where to find them later on tonight. Now, one group I spoke to staged a protest outside Barclays Bank in Princes Street, and they were citing that bank's financial backing for various arms exporters such as BAE Systems and Elbit Systems. Barclays, I was told, is investing globally over $4 billion across the arms trade. One member of the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign in Scotland told us that it's bombs from America, the UK and Germany, which are being used to commit what he called genocide that we see in our televisions. The campaign, which has seen, he said, a groundswell of support, wants to go further and demand a boycott to Israel and calling for an immediate ceasefire. The Scottish Socialist Party also held a protest and a petition signing activity just along the street, and I spoke to former member of the Scottish Parliament, Colin Fox, who told me that the public response was overwhelming. He said they haven't seen this sort of public response and enthusiasm for a campaign since the referendum. He told me that people want a ceasefire and want the killing to stop and the talking to begin. He added that there is no military solution. If there was, they would have found it in the last 80 years. People, he says, are listening to this argument, and he feels that the UK parties, Conservative and Labour, should realise that they are out of sorts with the British people. Labour, he said, won't move and won't demand a ceasefire because they're terrified about, following the expulsion of Jeremy Corbyn, they're terrified about being labelled anti-Semitic. But he says that Israel does, of course, have the right to defend itself, but they don't have the right to kill 33,000 innocent Palestinians. Another protest shortly afterwards on the Waverley Bridge in Edinburgh was led by trade unionists, and among other things they read out the list of, the death toll among medics, doctors, nurses and other aid workers. Okay, so all that took place in Edinburgh last week, and I've got more later on. It was a busy day in Edinburgh. Do you want to move on before I come back to that story?
Sure, do you want to talk about... I just want to talk a little bit about our First Minister's interview on Hard Talk, Stephen Sacker, just because we know lots of people in Scotland don't subscribe to the BBC, but I thought you might be interested in hearing his half an hour on Hard Talk. Hard Talk is a BBC World News debating interview, notoriously hard, if you like. Stephen Sacker is a journalist of some repute, Cambridge educated, but you know, he has lots of experience of world journalism in different areas, but he doesn't ever give whoever's on Hard Talk an easy time. But I felt that Hamza definitely stood his ground and did well. They started off, of course, with the police investigation, as they always do. We never seem to start off when we talk to Westminster's ministers or cabinet ministers about their police investigations, but it always seems to be the SNP one. Anyway, and he also said that polling shows SNP votes are likely to be down, the party's going to lose. First Minister sort of counteracted that by talking about record levels of junior doctors joining the Scottish NHS, children out of poverty in Scotland, and how much better we are in those sort of figures than the rest of the UK. Although very quickly, Sacker took them back to investigating fraud and highest drug deaths. As soon as health was mentioned, he mentioned that, and our First Minister went on to talk about how they were trying to tackle that and how it was difficult because it was Westminster policy, which was
drugs policy is covered by the Food and Dangerous Drugs Act 1971. I think
that's
the Scottish government doesn't have any
They have a great deal of trouble wanting to change things when it comes to that. But he did say it was an issue of concern, and they wanted to stop it. Then he went on to talk about a big furore that's been happening all over YouTube and everywhere else, I think, is the Hate Crime Act. And he actually, Stephen Sacker, said Scotland was at war over it, which I thought was a bit sensationalist. And he discussed J.K. Rowling's arguments and her comments on things that the police Scotland agreed did not meet the threshold for calling it a hate crime. Said something about transgender activists thought that it should, according to Sacker. I don't know, he didn't quote who he was talking about there, but he was saying that people are, transgender activists are saying that Rowling's comments should be considered as part of the hate crime. But the First Minister disagreed and said obviously it had to be at a certain level, just like we said last week. I think we talked about the hate crime bill, didn't you hear? It has to be a certain level of criminality before you can intervene. Makes it reasonable. Again, they brought up his old speech, which lots of fairly right-wing, even Sacker, agreed that they were very extremely right-wing. Some of these YouTubers or commenters were bringing up the old speech that Hamza Yousaf gave on talking about how few BAM people there were in prominent positions in Scotland. He was using, that speech was used, as he said then, backing up the Black Lives Matter campaign and saying, yeah, let's look at Scotland. It wasn't saying Scotland, we know, is a predominantly white country. He wasn't saying people of colour had to take these positions. He was just pointing out how few people of colour there were in those positions. And to me, it didn't seem like a... It's up to you, listeners, but to me, it didn't seem like a particularly racist speech at all. He was just pointing out facts, as far as I could see.
I'll have to actually look at that in context. I've only seen on YouTube, well, people who are critics of the Scottish Government often show a wee clip of that. Hamza talks about how... How many boards are all white? But I mean, I'd like to look at the whole speech. As you said, that was several years ago. It's not a thing he says every week, but absolutely. They always drag that up.
They do seem on the as a way of criticising the Hate Crime Act. He did talk a little bit about the making complaints, even though you can make a complaint, even though, like you said last week, even though it might not go further to be considered a crime, you can make a complaint. And he said that came from the Stephen Lawrence inquiry recommendation, and that's why. Personally, I've heard an argument which I thought was quite good. We could do similar with rape and sexual abuse. We could do a similar kind of system, because we know that rape and sexual abuse is so rarely fully prosecuted, you know, rarely successful, you know. Maybe we could do a similar thing, and maybe they'll look into that when they're looking into misogyny, which they haven't done in this one. They're doing it separately.
That's right. There will be a bill on make misogyny a crime. That is going, well, it's not in the parliament yet, but it will be, I think, this year.
And then he went on to talk about Gaza, and he's discussed that some of his wife's family were there, and he said it's beyond imagination what's happening there. And he was, I thought, visibly upset by it. And it was, for me, nice to see an actual one of our leading politicians in this country making that comment. And he said we needed to stop arms sales right away, like you said. UK government had to stop it. And that if they didn't, they were complicit in the war crimes. And it was no doubt in his mind. He said there was plenty of evidence out there to show that it was war crimes. And I think the people of Scotland in the main seem to agree with him on that one. And obviously his response to the October Hamas attacks was that was absolutely beyond horrific. There's no question about that. But he was saying that the Israeli response to that was beyond a reasonable response, and it was falling into the war crimes part. Sacker addressed our First Minister's visit to Turkey, saying he overstepped the mark there, according to Lord Cameron, and he quickly said no, he didn't. He was completely and utterly entitled as the Scottish First Minister to talk to other governments. He wasn't allowed to sign treaties, and he never was intending to do that. And he had asked Lord Cameron to have a discussion on this, but as yet he hasn't taken him up on that offer. And then finally they went on to talk about the mandate for independence, and they said he was saying that at the next election, if the SNP wins, then we're really looking at that's a mandate for a referendum, that the UK government should allow us to have that referendum. But he actually said quite nicely at the end, he said they won't allow us to have a referendum, he said, because they're feared that we may win. I thought that was quite a good way to end it, and he handled it well. He was measured, and he answered his questions, and he came across to me I'm not a massive fan of Hamza, but to me he came across as a very reasonable politician in the UK. I don't have that many these days that we can say that.
I know we're in a period of a lack of personality. Yeah, we will discuss some of these points later on, but it just occurs to me right now, it's a bit ironic that unelected Lord Cameron is telling the elected First Minister of Scotland that he's not in his place. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll come back to that anyway. We'll have a chat and a discussion, the two of us, at the end of the show. Let's just quickly go on to the next story I covered in Edinburgh. This was also last Saturday. The Let Women Speak public meeting. This is one of a series of meetings run by Kelly J. Keane, the Women's Rights campaigner, and it's really a kind of open mic, I think you would call it, around various cities in Scotland and England, and also in other countries. She takes a sound system, really. She introduces and then she invites people to speak, usually women, who spoke last Saturday, because I watched the whole thing, in fact. And we do have some video of it. That will either appear at the end of this programme or it might be in some video shorts on the YouTube version. But Jeanette will tell us, you know more about that than I do, so you can explain the YouTube coverage. So very quickly, Kelly J. Keane said, introduced the act, the event, and invited women to speak, and she makes it clear that what they're all about is they don't think that men can transition to be a woman. That's really what she says, and then other people are allowed to come up and say whatever they want. Many of the people speaking, again, spoke out against the hate crime bill, because what they were concerned about is that if a woman says, for example, that a trans woman, a person transitioning from being man to woman, wants to get into a women's club or any place, or women's changing rooms or a women's sports team, the women all said, no, we've got the right to say no, we don't think you're a woman. Incidentally, there was another demonstration there at the same time. Well, it wasn't a demonstration. I must say that the women always said, we're not a demonstration, we're a meeting. Trans rights campaigners had a demonstration against the meeting. Now, the police in Edinburgh had divided the groups into two. So before everybody arrived, crush barriers were set up, and the Let Women Speak campaign was on one side next to Princes Street. This was at the Mound, by the way. And the protesters against the Let Women Speak event were at the other side, sort of facing towards the castle. The protesters mainly played pop songs through a sound system, did karaoke singing. But there's also one or two speeches. And one speaker, who was an academic, said that the reason they were there, because they think women and feminists need to widen out the definition of women to include people that used to be men, but who have now chosen to be women. I'm not making any comment, I'm just telling you what they said. So basically that's the division there. The Let Women Speak campaigners, they're saying, no, we are women, we were born girls and we are now women, and that's it. And the other group think that whether you're a woman or not is a matter of choice. It's flexible. So what do you think? As Joanne Cherry puts it, is sex immutable? Are you stuck with the sex you were born with? Or is sex a matter of consumer choice? I guess that's what we're saying. Anyway, the event took place peacefully, although very noisily. I'll just finish before I move on saying that although there were supposed to be two different events, one group of mainly men who were next to me turned up next to the women's meeting, and they made a lot of noise. They had loud hailers set on. You know that sirens sound you can make an emergency siren setting, and it just bleeps and makes this really loud noise. And they had a couple of them. And in between they would chant, and what they were chanting was that Kelly J. Keane's a Nazi. I didn't see any sign of any Nazis there. I was saying to the police, surely you should move these guys along. The demonstration is supposed to be up there, but these young men have mainly came here to drown out. They made it perfectly clear. They were there to stop people hearing the women from speaking. I've raised that question with Police Scotland, why didn't they move these guys along? Because they stood right next to the cops and didn't say anything. Okay, so there should be some video of that as well. That will maybe show you at the end, or it might be in the shorts. So, Jeanette, have you got that piece on the WASPI campaign, something we've talked about previously?
It's not really particularly WASPI. It's a little bit WASPI, but it's really about, because one of our contributors to the Facebook page said we should talk about, when we asked, what do you think we should talk about, they suggested we talk about the incredibly low state pension that we have in the UK. Obviously, it's Westminster that decides the UK state pension. It's not a Scottish government decision. So a wee bit about WASPI, but debate because there's a motion tabled by Patricia Gibson, SNP MP. She tabled it last year, and it's happening on the 16th of April, where there'll be a debate on the compensation that the Ombudsman has suggested, and also there'll be a vote at the end of that, and whether or not WASPI women born in the 1950s that had to wait from 60 to 66 to get their state pension, whether or not they're entitled to compensation. And I believe next week you'll be out at Holyrood again, maybe interviewing some of those ladies that are going to be out there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We should take the camera out there. Yeah. We'll definitely do that.
They're going to be out there demonstrating on this issue, keeping it in the forefront. They've done a great job getting out there and keeping this fight up. So the fight is to get state pension for many women, as we know, because for many women, it's their only source of income in retirement. It's quite different, really, from lots of men. So it's especially true this of working class women, women that have had jobs maybe that started as a cleaner in the health service or whatever, but that job was contracted out or whatever it happens to be, and suddenly they find themselves 30, 40 years down the line, and the only pension they've got to look forward to is their state pension. Yeah. They don't have anything else. And that's especially true if you look at women through the 60s, 70s, 80s even, 90s even, would you believe, who worked part-time because of their caring responsibilities that they had, either for their children or disabled family members or indeed older family members. It's massively women who do this free caring work. They maybe took career breaks as well. They went back part-time. I remember when I was working part-time as a lecturer all those years ago, we were in England and we weren't allowed to join the pension scheme until you got mm-hmm. a permanent job. And that was many women were in that situation. Yeah, so accessing these, if you like, employer pensions or private pensions is a difficult one. For many women. I spoke to somebody recently and they said, oh, I don't know what the big issue is because I'm 60 and I'm getting my pension, so why are these WASPI women shouting out? But of course she was talking about a civil service pension, which she wasn't talking about the state pension, and she didn't realise that she was in a privileged position to have that, because mm-hmm. really loads of women don't have that. And that highlighted to me the massive difference between people who will have employer pensions, private pensions, whatever they have, and those that are relying on the state pension. And I kind of, that was the sort of thing that was brought about by Thatcherism, really. It was like, we won't raise the state pension so much, unlike what they did in Spain and Germany, etc. That was the main pension for everybody. You know, it goes up and down depending on income. It's not dead easy. You compare pensions across Europe. But Thatcher was more, oh no, you will have a separate sort of pension that stands out from mm-hmm. your state one.
They wanted to be run by banks, don't they?
Yes,
they wanted
to
create a market opportunity for the financial sector.
That's exactly what it was. It was a massive opportunity for hedge funds, etc., to use this pension money, which they couldn't really do if it was just our contributions, our WI contributions. So women are about twice as likely, even now, even currently, that to just be relying on the state pension.
I did hear Keir Starmer recently saying that, well, he's making an appeal to the working class when they launched the local government campaign in England a couple of weeks ago, and he was almost saying, he didn't use the S word, he didn't say socialist, but he was always saying that, you know, putting the demands of working people first is now going to be a Labour priority. So let's remind him of that then if he becomes Prime Minister. Now, who's going to do the next story? I've got the cast story. Will I do it now? Then you've got Balak, okay. Now, this is breaking news today as we recorded this show. We just heard it literally a couple of hours ago about the release of a long-awaited report called a Cass Report. And this is a report compiled by Dr. Hilary Cass for England and Wales. So why are we doing it in News for Scotland? I think you'll see this is going to have its impact in Scotland, and it has begun to do it this morning. I don't know what people have been saying in the last couple of hours since we've been setting up the recording, but it came out this morning. So what are we talking about? This is the final report into children's gender health services in England and Wales. The interim report was already published a couple of years ago, and that led to the closure of the GIDS clinics in England, who were the place children were referred to if they were engaged in some sort of gender distress, if they felt they were born in the wrong body. Then he was sent straight to the there's a big waiting list. The equivalent in Scotland is the Sandyford Clinic, and they also have a big waiting list, but that was the specialist dealing with that kind of patient. However, the interim report from Dr. Cass already had declared the GID clinic in England closed, and also led to the announcement a few weeks ago that puberty blockers were not routinely to be given to children in that category. The Scottish government didn't do anything about it at the time. They said that's an English report, it's got nothing to do with us. And as far as we know, they haven't made any statement today about the full CAST report. The health policy, of course, is fully devolved to the Scottish government. So in a sense, they're quite right, of course, the decision of the English NHS doesn't have any legal effect here whatever. However, the same policies have been followed in Scotland and in England. So if those policies have been questioned in England, maybe they should be questioned here as well. Dr. Cass's report reveals that the previous practice of treating gender-confused young people was not based on adequate research. In fact, the clinical guidelines used throughout the world have in fact flouted medical standards that are in fact based on poor evidence. And that's the opinion of the BMA, who've given their immediate response to the report today. Many countries have followed the advice of an organisation called WPATH, which is a controversial organisation led by a coalition of medics and trans rights campaigners. A University of York report cited by Dr. Cass found evidence that the research used by WPATH was, in their words, wholly inadequate. The evidence on the effectiveness of gender-affirming care and the long-term evidence of the effects on a patient's fertility, bone density, heart health, and indeed improved satisfaction with your body following any modifications, the evidence is either lacking or inconsistent. Megan Gallagher for the Scottish Conservatives this morning called for the use of puberty blockers to be blocked in Scotland, and SNP Member of Parliament Joanne Cherry, KC, said today that the CAST review had utterly vindicated the views of a campaign group that she supports called the LGB Alliance, Lesbian and Gay Alliance, adding that politicians who had called them a hate group should hang their heads in shame and read the report. We haven't seen any comment yet from the Scottish Government or from the Scottish Green Party. The NHS Scotland has been following the WPATH affirmative care approach. Will there now be a change in policy? I've got one more story, which is on football. Jeanette, were you going to cover...
I was.
What was the other one?
Balloch Highland Games.
Let's go to Balloch.
So on the Scotland Welcomes You website, you'll find a list of Highland Games in different localities. So they describe them as a range of piping and drumming competitions and individual pipers and drummers, and some caber tossing, that's my favourite, Highland dancing, athletic events. So great fun and great food and drink may be taken, and combined with the grandeur of the Scottish scenery, it says, and the games are a must-see for visitor attractions. I think most of us would agree with that one, with that definition on the Scotland Welcomes You website. So it's understandable that the cancellation of the Balloch Highland Games has met with dismay from the locals. Mossoballoch Park in July usually has a Balloch Highland Games, but it's lost its 14,000 council funding, so can't take place. Some people are sympathetic with the council, saying this type budgets are so tight and they've got priorities, obviously, in social care and things like that, which are taking precedence over things like, you know, Highland Games or other festivals. The council seems incredibly sorry about what they've done. They know it's an unpopular decision, but they say cuts, budgets are stretched so far. It's harsh, obviously, for the many performers, including the youngsters and volunteers who coach them in the dancing and the music. Often they do this out of their own time and their own pocket, you know, as well as for the athletes. It's also a loss to village businesses, as visitors were around 9,000 last year. And Balloch is a renowned tourist destination, and these games take place in the middle of the school summer holidays. Loch Lomond Highland Games Committee made the decision to cancel after the news of the Western Bartonshire Council cut to the budget. But here's hoping they can run it next year. They're hoping to find alternative funding, because festivals and culture events like these are part of our inheritance, wouldn't you say? And are good for our youngsters and our communities, as well as good for tourism. I remember seeing one last year in Kirkcudbright, and all the wee tiny lasses that were doing the Highland dance. They were absolutely beautiful. So they were, and the boys following a few guys, they were mainly boys, there were some girls in it as well, doing the drumming and the pipe band. And I thought, that's absolutely fantastic that these kids are getting this opportunity, and we're getting the opportunity to see it as well. So I hope they do find the funding and it comes back.
I certainly hope so. I only went to one Highland Games myself last year, which was Kilmarnock, and that was great fun. I did intend to go to others, but there's always something on. But see, the Kilmarnock Games, it's just a wee one, but there was loads of people there from all around the world. I met Canadians, I met Germans, met people from the Czech Republic, you know. And all I'm saying is that if they think, it's a stupid way of doing funding, doing accounting, you know. You think this is costing money. It's not. It's making money. But there just isn't any way of tying it up. Obviously, local businesses are making money from these visitors, but it's not helping the council. It's crazy economics. We've got something that's good, which people enjoy, and is benefiting the economy, and we can't afford it. And that's just nuts.
You're right. But I feel for the council, because you can understand they're really stretched, and they've got, you know, poor wee women that really need somebody to come in and help them get onto the toilet and help them get washed and everything. They've got to prioritise their funding. So it's
okay. Today, are we a bit done? Will we just do the football now?
Go on for your football. Right.
News for Scotland doesn't regularly do football because we don't know an awful lot about it. But I'd like to suggest that we start covering the Scottish international women's team, because they don't get enough coverage and they could do with some more support. I'll tell you why in a minute. Anyway, I was at Hampden last night to watch the Scottish women against Slovakia, and this is the second Euro qualifier in this campaign, and we won 1-0. Although the game was fairly dull, and it adds to a goalless draw last Friday, which I wasn't at. I was in Serbia, but folks say there wasn't much happened then, certainly no goals. Pretty dull football, but still, the manager, Pedro Martinez Losa, is very pleased to have 4 points from two games. And he says the team is on their way to the finals in 2025 in Switzerland. Okay, so they've made a start, but although I'm no expert, but I think they need somebody who can score goals, Jeanette. Okay, now what the other important point, in last night's game, Rachel Corsi, our captain, received her 150th cap. There's some smashing players in that team, but I don't know what they need to do to make it a bit more exciting. And we find that there were about 3,100 in Hampden, and so we were among them. So previously, Hampden games have had over 5,000, so the Scottish team has been on a poor run recently. So let's hope those 4 points, the fact that we're now doing, I think, second in the group, people will be encouraged to support them. Just finally, before we move on, as we came in, we picked up a leaflet from a couple of folk who were saying, these were Palestine protesters again, they were saying, Israel's in Scotland's group, we should be boycotting, we shouldn't be playing football. And they're saying, well, everyone's boycotted Russia because of their invasion in Ukraine. The Russian team can't take part. Russian athletes have to perform individually, but not officially as Russians. Sort of saying, if you can do it to Russia, why can't you do it to Israel? Again, I'm just telling you what happened. What is your opinion? That's what we saw last night. So I think that's those are the stories. We'll just chat over some of the issues that come up.
Yeah, go on.
Let me see. What did we say, first of all? That was 20 minutes ago or something.
The economy, right, and consumption.
Some people are skint, right, that's that.
People are skint, they certainly are. It's funny you said it about the food, because I thought people's food bills have like doubled, because they really have, you know. I think I noticed ketchup the other day, it was like £5 or something, it was crazy. Obviously that was some crazy shop that I can't go back to. But I think food bills have really increased, but you're saying not, maybe as a proportion of income.
I've just realised something,
yeah.
Actually, you've just pointed out a flaw in the argument, if you like. the argument is, as I said, if people get richer, they spend less as a percentage on food more on holidays and so forth.
Yeah.
But of course, one of the reasons why that percentage isn't changing is because of food inflation, so that's definitely an element of it.
Yeah, right. So, 'cause it certainly has, what people are saying. Good point. Their food bills have doubled, their heating has doubled, their rent and mortgages went up incredibly. Absolutely. You really are in a crisis.
Now, when you were talking about the interview with Hamza the other day, it strikes me that they always ask the same question. So Stephen Sacker is a renowned interviewer, of course, and it's called Hard Talk. He's not going to give you an easy ride.
Yeah,
not
sure
he should, but you could have predicted what questions he was going to ask, couldn't you? He's going to talk about drug deaths, Mm-hmm. He's going to talk about the legal actions, and he's going to... What was the other big point he talked about?
All the investigation constantly going on about that. And what else? Drug deaths, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, now these things are not unimportant, though, but those are always the things that the mainstream media singles out, because, well, they see... I think it is true. They look at what's going bad, and they'll say, right, we're going to talk about these items, right? There might be a dozen things that are going very well, but we're not going to talk about them, because this is hard talk.
Yeah, true, but to be fair, the First Minister really held his own. He came across well, I thought. I'd like to hear what other people think. MD else saw it. I know we watched the BBC because we pay our licence. because my man is addicted to BBC News. He's got to watch that. So I get to watch that. But I know lots of Scots don't, for a whole variety of good reasons why they don't, you know, support the BBC. But I actually thought that wasn't too bad an interview. I mean, I've seen him attacking people more ferociously. But yes, it was the same. We knew those questions were going to come up, the same stuff. It was well prepared for them, though. He handled himself really good. And I thought it was quite good at the end, saying the UK government won't give us a referendum because they're feared. I liked that.
Well, I think that's perfectly true. Right? So let's just go over that point again.
We think that. You might not, but we do.
Well, I'm glad you gave such a thorough account, because I'm one of those people that doesn't pay the BBC licence. So well done. Incidentally, before I move on, just to remind you, last week on the Spotify thing, we talked about the Scottish football not being on the Scottish television. So that's one of the reasons I'm not a big fan of the BBC. But somebody said on Twitter yesterday that the Scottish STV covered the football last night, but not the Scottish football. Apparently you could... Somebody said on Twitter, is this true? Somebody said you could watch the Irish game on the Scottish TV, but not the Scottish game. What is wrong with broadcasting in this country? Well, that's why we're here.
Especially it's called STV.
Well, that's why we have News for Scotland. Now, just before I move on to another point, I've just realised you were going to talk about a blue badge.
Yes. Just a reminder from one of our listeners, actually, just to say everybody should check your date on the blue badge, because sometimes people forget to check it and it goes out of date and there's like a £1,000 fine, did she say something like that? Some crazy fine that you could get. So if you're a blue badge holder, please make sure you check its in date and apply before, because it's taken a wee while to get that, so make sure you've applied a good few months before it expires.
Okay, right. So let's get that. Remind people of that. Have we got time for any more discussion?
What else? What's your burning?
I was just going to go back to the Hamza and the question of the... Well, as he said correctly, there isn't going to be a referendum. Nobody in Westminster is going to give a referendum, and I guess he's right, because it would probably be a yes vote, I would think. The support for referendum is something like 50%, it depends on how the campaign goes, of course. But if you remember when Alex Salmond agreed to with David Cameron to hold the referendum, that was agreed in 2012, and then the referendum was in 2014. Support for independence was at 25%, and that's why Cameron agreed to it. Mm-hmm. At the moment, support for independence is somewhere between 45% and 50%. Sometimes it goes to 52%. It depends what polls you look at. But there's no chance that London is going to agree to a referendum if there's a good, fair chance they could lose it. So that's definitely not going to happen. But what do you think of this idea, then, that if we win the election, we're going to... Well, I thought that the idea was that if the SNP win this election and if they put independence on a manifesto, that itself means you don't need a referendum because the people have just voted for it.
I think it's going to be really hard work to make that happen. Not that we won't maybe get an SNP, you know, majority, but it's just that it's going to be hard for us to prove that that means that we have the right to declare independence or have a referendum or whatever. I just think it's going to be difficult.
I think it's about international support, isn't it? If a country... Well, look at Catalonia, for example, who declared independence and are not independent.
It's not a country, though. We're a country.
But they're
a region.
I agree. We are a country. Now, the thing is, you have to have international support, that's what I'm saying. So the main reason why Catalonia isn't a country is because nobody recognised them as a country.
It's never been a country. I'm all for Catalonians having their independence, whatever, but I mean, Scotland has always been a country. So it's kind of a different position. We've got a stronger position. you know, I would say.
That's true. I think there is a difference, yeah. But it's about, it's about international recognition. So let me give you a scenario then. So supposing the SNP won either election, either the Westminster one or a Holyrood one, and for the first time, because they've never actually done this before, for the first time, if you actually say, right at the front of a manifesto, which everybody gets through the doors, and in all the leaflets, it says, a vote for SNP and we will declare independence.
Yeah.
If it clearly spells that out, and then if either if we win the majority of MSPs or MPs, or else if we win 51% of the actual numbers of people who vote, then I would then say, yes, declare independence and write to the United Nations and write to the European Union. And as soon as somebody says, yes, we recognise you and we're going to send you an ambassador, it could be anybody, it could be Macedonia, it could be Patagonia, it could be Iceland. As long as somebody says, yes, we're going to send our ambassador to Edinburgh, you send your ambassador over here. As soon as one person does that, one country, you're then recognised, you've then joined the community of nations. There's a scenario for you. Do you like that?
I like your scenario. I like it, yeah. I don't know if it's going to work, but I like it.
But the weakness of it, of course, if you don't get, if you get 49% of the votes, that doesn't work. And, of course, if the SNP doesn't win 40 MPs in the next election, if they, well, one opinion poll says they're going to win 41, another poll says they're going to win 19. So there's a fair chance it's not going to happen anyway. All right, what do you think of that? Let us know.
Let us know. Please do on our Facebook page, News for Scotland. If you put News for Scotland all together and an at in front of it, you'll find us easy enough. And you'll find us the same way on YouTube, but you can find us, it's on our Facebook page, how to get to our YouTube. And this show will be out on YouTube on Friday and also out on Podbeam, which goes out through Spotify. I think
I do the audio edition. I was just going to go over the Podbeam. If you have the Podbeam app, that's the one that's they host the stuff.
Yeah,
and but a lot of people don't have the Podbeam app, but you can also find our audio version on Spotify and on Google Podcasts, and it's also on Amazon Podcasts. The audio version is in various places. And as Jeanette says, from now, from this week, you can find us on YouTube.
Indeed. And thanks very much for watching us.
Okay, just before we summarise on the YouTube thing, I can also, Jeanette, I didn't discuss this with you, but I think we should thank the rest of the team. Tony's here pointing the camera in the right direction, so thank you, Tony. And Yvonne's not here, but Yvonne's busy doing the paperwork. Very important, she says.
Yeah.
And thanks to Sean for editing and producing the video.
Absolutely, and thanks to Glasgow Caledonian University Podcast Studio for allowing us in and being fabulously inviting and welcoming.
Okay, so obviously you're watching this on YouTube, and there will be some other YouTube clips. There will be some of the roving reporting that we're doing.
Oh yes, there will.
And I think some of that will be at the end of the show, and some of it is also going to be on wee YouTube shorts. So just keep looking for them, and we're hoping to do them every week round about Scotland. It's News for Scotland. It's news for we are.
Thank you very much.